Good morning. Time once again to bring you the reports from the news centers of the world. And first, from the newsroom in San Francisco, we take you to the United Nations headquarters in Australia. Go ahead, Australia.
Mr. Sidney Albright, calling from Australia.
Go ahead, Mr. Albright.
This is Sidney Albright calling from Australia. The time is 11 o'clock on Sunday evening. An officer friend of mine who recently returned from an undisclosed Allied operational base told me a story about ground crews, the men whose duty it is to keep the planes in the air. He said, it seemed to me while I was up there that these boys should be given much more recognition. In fact, I don't think they've been given any. Our pilots are hopeless without them. A picture of the Indianapolis Speedway comes to my mind. The car is made ready, tuned to the battle. Then the driver takes over. Sure, the driver's job is tremendous. Don't get me wrong. But where would he be without a competent pit crew? Each plane has its own ground crew consisting of about 9 men. This number varies based on the type of plane and the number of men available. Each man has his own job to do. And the minute a plane lands, the ground crews, like ants, swarm all over it, under the general direction of a crew chief, who is usually a sergeant. It is their task to see that the plane will not only fly to its best performance, but that it will also fight to the maximum. Now, up where we were, the officer added, the crews are usually up before crack of dawn, preparing the ships for dawn patrol. Everything must be in tip-top shape before the takeoff. Then the crew chief gives the okay. On that okay actually depends the life of the pilot, and all the pilots know it, too. There is a distinct understanding between the pilot and his ground crew, which can be described as mutual admiration. Maybe this is not exactly the term to use, but it is closely akin to it. I give you a concrete example. An air raid is on. The fighter pilots are strapping on their parachutes, while the crew is busily engaged in a last-minute inspection. When the pilot finally settles into the cockpit, getting ready to take off, you can almost feel the tenseness in every member of the crew as they stand by wiping off perspiration with grimy hands. You can almost feel them saying a prayer that the ship with its pilot will come back. During the time the pilot is actually in combat, they find very little that will hold their interest. Some pace nervously up and down, while others just sit on the ground and wait. Occasionally, a pilot returns from combat because of a well-placed enemy hit, which forces him to return to his base. When this happens, the crew, recognizing the familiar number of their plane, will rush onto the field, the plane's wheels having barely touched the ground. And while it is still in motion, the ground crew instantly spread themselves all over the ship, patching machine gun holes, repairing broken wires, replacing ammunition belts. On one such occasion, the plane was literally riddled with bullet holes. In 12 minutes, it was back in the air fighting. After the pilot finishes his day's work, the ground crew then begin a job that amounts to almost a complete overhaul of the plane, all the while discussing the pilot's accomplishments for the day. Bending over a carburetor, one of them will say, "We did a good job today. We shot down those 2 zeros in no time at all." The other mechanic will reply, "We sure did." These men on the ground, some of whom have never flown and probably never will, are just as much a part of the plane as the motors. They eat, drink, and live their job. Very little is said about them, but the pilots know, and they feel a special glow of enthusiasm when they can return and tell their boys on the ground that they gave the nips a licking. The hardest part of their job is when the pilot does not return. They try to keep their emotions to themselves. They will say, "Well, that's part of the game." But they're not fooling anybody, and they know it. More often, they'll walk off by themselves and burst into tears. I now return you to San Francisco.
That was Sidney Albright speaking from Australia. Now, for further reports, we take you to the newsroom in New York.
Before hearing from our next commentator, here's a bulletin from Moscow. The Russians announced that their armies fought vigorously on the defensive all through the night in the Izium-Barvinkovo salient below Kharkov. The Germans, you know, have claimed repeatedly that the entire Kharkov battle is over, that the Soviet drive on that big steel center has been smashed. And now across the Atlantic to John McVane, who reports this morning direct from Belfast, Ireland.
This is Belfast. The British Royal Air Force last night made the biggest raid in the whole history of air warfare. More than 1,000 British bombers thundered into Germany to plaster Cologne and the vital industrial Ruhr and Rhineland with a weight of incendiaries and high explosives that turned that closely packed mass of factories and foundries into a sea of flame and ruin. So far, the detailed reports haven't come out, but it's known that the raid was an outstanding success. The fires could be seen from the Dutch coast 150 miles away. And this morning, the target area was covered with a thick cloud of smoke 15,000 feet high. British fighters were up, too, during the night, attacking German aerodromes and German fighters that tried to intercept the British bombing force. Only 44 British planes are missing. That's less than 5% of the total force, a loss that doesn't approach the danger point of 10%. This region of Germany is the country's industrial heart. The heaviest raid ever made on London was something like half the size of last night's. And those of us who were in the two biggest London raids have some idea of the immensity of this raid on Germany. Mr. Churchill today sent a message of congratulation to the chief of the British Bomber Command. He spoke of the remarkable organization of the raid and the fact that without any confusion, such a tremendous force was able to do its work over the area in only an hour and a half. He said the raid was a proof of the hell Germany will get city by city from now on. You can't put too much stress on the brilliance of the organization of such a tremendous raid. Planes must move on a second schedule with all the coordination, the springs and cogwheels and a fine watch. The fact that such a raid could be carried out gives plenty of proof that air circles in Britain weren't boasting when they talked of a future nightly average of 1,000 planes over Germany. In Libya, there's still hard fighting in the desert region of Knightsbridge. The enemy armored forces have been unceasingly attacked by British ground and air forces, and the Axis units have suffered considerable damage. The four-day battle is now at its climax, and it's officially stated by the British that the situation is not unfavorable. I've been seeing a lot of the American forces since I came to Northern Ireland. Those I've been with are well-housed and well-fed. They say they're getting plenty of American food. They're interested in learning what they can from the British, and they seem to be in good spirits. But because these men of ours are intelligent, they want to know what's going on in the world, and it's difficult for them to find out where they're in the middle of the Irish countryside. They don't see the local papers very often. There are good reasons why some definite attempts should be made every day to explain the developments of the war to them. One officer I met in an army camp yesterday said, there have been rumors that the day we moved into this camp, Lord Haw-Haw announced it on the German radio and stated the Germans were coming over to bomb it. I told the American officer I'd heard dozens of similar stories in the last couple of years. You never find anyone who actually does hear that broadcast of Haw-Haw's. And invariably, when you investigate, you find Haw-Haw never said anything of the kind. Last night in the Belfast Hotel, a corporal and a private stopped me. They figured I could settle an argument. One man from Scranton said, we've been hearing the rumor that Wall Street and Lloyd's of London are betting the war will be over in 110 days. Is there any truth in it? I said, as far as I knew, there was no truth at all in the rumor. It struck me after the conversation that the education of these army men on the war issues and war development is important. The American boys in Ireland are working hard. When they have any spare time, they need physical recreation. But a few minutes every day or so to get a general picture of the war from a well-informed officer would seem to be time well spent. This is John McVane in Belfast, returning you to New York.
We take you now to the Swedish capital, where we hear from David Anderson.
This is David Anderson speaking from Stockholm. Here in Sweden today, we're caught between the crosswinds of the German and Russian victory reports. And while I won't attempt to explain one or the other, there are some interesting sidelights given today from Berlin on the so-called spring offensive. As I reported to you before, the Swedish correspondents in Berlin, reflecting the attitude of competent German circles, had said that when a real German offensive began, it would break out on all fronts simultaneously. This may have been borne out by the military spokesman, Wilhelmstrasse, a couple of days ago when he said, quote, you've not seen anything yet, unquote. Well, today German reports say that it is unlikely that we can regard the previous offensives as merely pre-offensives. They are, according to these reports, all part of a general offensive which the Germans have promised all along. So far, then, we have seen three phases of this offensive, that on the Kerch Peninsula, that around Kharkov, and that in North Africa. One correspondent goes on to predict the possible location of a fourth phase, and he puts it in the central sector of the Eastern Front with Moscow as the main objective. With regard to Rommel's offensive in North Africa, reports from Berlin have differed as to his possible objectives. Some say that this time Rommel has his eye on the whole of Egypt and beyond, but the progress which Rommel has made so far has tended to tone down these grandiose predictions. Now military circles in Berlin seem content to call Rommel's immediate objective as being Tobruk. But there's no doubt that the Germans assess great importance to Rommel's moves. It is suggested that the ultimate objective will be to cut the British supply line through the Suez Canal, quote, as an alternative to invasion to the British Isles, unquote. With this in mind, the Germans, according to Berlin report, have given Rommel new troops, which now give him disposition over, quote, several armies, unquote. Then, too, he is supposed to have been supplied with the newest weapons which the Germans possess, the ones which the Germans claim broke the back of the Russian resistance on the Kerch Peninsula. So if we were to reflect German opinion on the importance of the various fronts, our attention today will be drawn to North Africa and possibly to the central sector of the Eastern Front. This is David Anderson returning you now to New York.
For this morning's news on the domestic front, we take you now to Washington.
In Washington, America's production chief of the First World War is back on the job. Bernard Baruch will work with the Army Ordnance Chief, Major General Levin Campbell, Jr., advising him on the $30 billion Army supply program. Baruch will be one of a four-man brain trust serving without pay. Other members of the advisory staff are the president of the Chrysler Corporation, K.T. Keller, the head of the United States Steel, Benjamin Fairless, and Lewis Brown, president of Johns Manville. The United States is getting Lend-Lease aid from our allies as well as handing it out, and Lend-Lease Administrator Edward Stettinius, Jr., says that the United Nations are really fighting this war as members of a gigantic cooperative. According to Stettinius, our forces in foreign lands are being furnished with much-needed supplies without any cash payment. For instance, ever since our troops first landed in Northern Ireland, they have been supplied with food and other necessities by the British. And the same goes in Australia. In fact, Stettinius says, there's been real pooling of resources by the United Nations. And the National Automobile Dealers Association is urging the government to take over used cars from dealers before considering any plan to commandeer private autos. The million used cars available are said to be in fine running shape for the most part, except for one thing, tires. Each auto needs an average of 1 1/3 recapped tires before it would be ready to roll. And in Madison, Wisconsin, Chinese military authorities believe the Japanese made an unsuccessful attempt to bomb the Panama Canal along with the attack on Pearl Harbor and Manila on December 7th. This is revealed by Dr. John Earl Baker, a Wisconsin University alumnus and former Inspector General of the Burma Road. He left China last February. Dr. Baker says the Chinese think a Japanese attack on the canal failed only because a Jap aircraft carrier was sunk somewhere in the eastern Pacific, thus costing the raiding planes their mother ship. Mexico City, a big tanker has blown up under suspicious circumstances in Tampico Harbor. The incident came within a few hours after the Senate approved President Avila Camacho's request for a declaration of war against the Axis. There were three explosions aboard the 8,000-ton tanker, Cacalao, when the fire broke out. 10 Americans and 2 Mexicans are known to have been hurt. Authorities are not certain of the cause of the blasts, which occurred while the tanker was being loaded with oil, but they suspect sabotage. And in Santiago, Chile, a Santiago newspaper, El Siglo, is vigorously declaring the solidarity of the Chilean people with Mexico. And it has called on the government of Chile to break off relations with the Axis and smash the fifth column. Of all the South American republics, only Chile and Argentina are still maintaining relations with the Axis. In Rio de Janeiro, President Vargas of Brazil has placed all Brazilian merchant marine sailors under military discipline. The action was taken as Brazil prepared to arm her merchant ships against Axis submarine warfare. And so, for the moment, that's all from Washington.
These have been the reports of John McBain from Belfast, Ireland, Sidney Albright from Australia, David Anderson from Stockholm, and the newsroom in Washington. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.